advance, STEAMed, science, technology, engineering, arts, mathematics, entrepreneurship, and design, education. I got involved because I want to expand opportunities for girls to be whoever they want. This became a focus of mine after a random exchange with an old friend from back home. We were catching up, and I told him I had 3 daughters. And do you know the first thing he said to me? Not congratulations or even, that's cool. He said, oh, you better get a shotgun. That's going to be hard. Why can't people say, you have daughters, man, they're going to be blessed. They're going to be something great. If I had a son, they would say, your son is going to be the greatest player ever. So I wanted to fund and develop an organization that could encourage girls to pursue the kinds of jobs where they'll be sitting at the table and creating the new world. Then there's the idea that I need a shotgun to protect them. That is so absurdly sexist, it's crazy. It denies the ability of a young girl to have aspirations higher than being an Instagram model. It dumbs down my relationship with them to being the guardian of their bodies instead of a champion of their minds and their personal and political growth. I want to teach my daughters, above all else, that their generation is going to be decisive, and as young people, they need to get off their behinds and realize the power they have. They are the future. I tell them that if you don't like the type of education you are receiving, you should research something yourself. You can look up anything you want, but please check the sources. You can teach yourself to do almost anything with YouTube. Right now, I could go look up how to fix a refrigerator and actually find a step-by-step tutorial. Unlike in past generations, the information is out there. It's a click away. But if you don't have a thirst for it, you'll be on a screen all day watching jackasses light themselves on fire or top 30 wardrobe malfunctions. We absolutely need great teachers. But young people can't wait for someone else to educate them. They have to educate themselves. And they have the power to do it. I am also vigilant about what my daughters are taught in their schools. We live in Hawaii during the off-season, and when I learned that my daughters weren't studying black history in their classes in Hawaii, I connected with a local historian, and we put together a Black History Month program for the school. In the process, I learned that black history is central to Hawaiian history. The first African people arrived in Hawaii by the early 1800s, and black people held it down on the island for centuries. Now I'm on the board of the Hawaiian Africana Museum, which is an actual thing. I did this for my daughters, but a side benefit is that I'm researching and learning stuff I didn't know and was never taught in school. The other day, a senior citizen told me about a subject she was researching. I asked at what point she would be satisfied with everything she knew, and she said, "To be honest, I'm a lifetime learner." That blew my mind because it's the honest truth. There is always something new to learn. Thinking through an intersectional lens, I supported the Women's March after Trump was elected. Several months later, I put out a written statement in solidarity with the Women's Strike for Equality on International Women's Day in March 2017. As a black man in America, I sometimes get overwhelmed and discouraged by what I see, from the police killings of unarmed black men to the unequal educational system, to the mass incarceration of poor people of color in for-profit prisons. But when I look in my daughter's eyes, I see the courage of Harriet Tubman, the patience of Rosa Parks, the soul of Ida B. Wells, the passion of Fannie Lou Hamer, and the heart of Angela Davis. I see the future. I see hope. And I'm inspired because it will be women who lead the future. That is why I am writing to express my unconditional solidarity with a women's strike on International Women's Day, March 8th. It would be easy for me to say that I am supporting this day of resistance because I have 3 daughters and I want nothing to stand in their way as they attempt to achieve their goals. I could also say that I am doing this because my wife Pele, my best friend and soulmate, is of Samoan descent and has lived the struggle of being a woman and the daughter of immigrants. But this issue is a lot bigger than my dreams for my own family. It's about the women across the earth who are suffering. Women who are less worried about a glass ceiling than they are about a collapsing floor. It's about women of color across the earth who live on less than $1 a day. It's about all women who are subject to sexual assault and violence. I stand with the women's strike because I agree with the unity statement from the strike's platform, which reads that this day is organized by and for women who have been marginalized and silenced by decades of neoliberalism directed towards working women, women of color, Native women, disabled women, immigrant women, Muslim women, lesbian, queer, and trans women. I encourage my fellow football players to join me in standing with these brave women from across the world. As Angela Davis once said, to understand how any society functions, you must understand the relationship between the men and the women. By that metric, our society is failing. We need change, and to quote Frederick Douglass, if there is no struggle, there is no progress. Sincerely, Michael Bennett. I have been doing work on women's issues, but this was my opportunity to make that bridge between philanthropy and activism. I was buzzing with it, doing my best impression of Sojourner Truth, saying, this is the time for women, a day that men have to stand up and speak the truth for women. I posted this letter online because I wanted women to know there are men out there supporting the women's movement. I can see through my daughter's eyes just how many obstacles girls and women face. Their brains, their achievements, their creativity, and their place in society can be cut down. And it's not like we have legions of smart men making the world a better place. We need all hands on deck. Not only am I willing to say that I support women, the definition of all talk, but I'm also going to help create more programs for women and girls and collaborate with great women who are already doing amazing things. In New York City, I spoke out for a group that provides support for survivors of domestic violence. One of my friends was killed by her partner, and it haunts me. At their conference, I talked about facts we can't deny, that domestic abuse is more widespread than we admit, and too many of us act like bystanders, turning the other way, deciding not to get involved, which sends the message that it's not our problem. Football has a lot of work to do when it comes to changing this culture that tolerates violence against women. I work in an environment where women are constantly being downplayed, and people don't even realize it. It's unconscious. The things that we say, the things that we do, send a message. The NFL sends a message that women don't matter with the way that for years, it has ignored the issue of violence against women by players. The NFL also sends a message through how the league markets itself to the general public. We're stuck in a 1950s mindset. The message is that a woman is only important as a cheerleader or at most a sideline reporter. We do this even though women make up almost half the NFL's fan base. For a month, we players dress in pink for breast cancer awareness. But we do nothing for awareness about sexism or domestic violence. It's as if the sexism baked into the league is more important than the financial benefits that could be gained by treating our female fans with the respect they deserve. I need to do this work in the outside world, but I also need to push where I stand as well. This is where my daughters come into the picture. Any struggle I take part in on their behalf is my way of paying them back for how they have changed my life. They have allowed me to evolve in a way that I think most football players never get to experience. By the time most players are retired, they don't know how to talk to women like human beings. They don't know how to interact with their wives or girlfriends. That's why the divorce rate for retired NFL players is over 80%. I'm not against divorce. If a marriage isn't working, then it isn't working. But it should end because two people are growing apart, not because one half of a couple hasn't grown at all. This problem starts early, as high school sports stars are taught to see girls and women as objects, the sexual spoils of being a star athlete. Parents, coaches, and schools often reinforce this instead of working to change it. I think all male high school athletes should take part in what is called the Coaching Boys into Men program, which teaches young men how to interact constructively with the girls and women in their lives. And when girls express an interest in football, rather than saying, make them cheerleaders, maybe we can start saying, let's teach them how to coach or become an executive or how to own a team. My daughters have opened my eyes to the need to move from philanthropy to activism. But I also credit Angela Davis once again and her book, Women, Race, and Class, an amazing intersectional work that ties together why women's liberation is liberation for all of us. Even if you disagree with her politics or her stances on issues, you cannot deny her overpowering intellect, her journey, and the persecution she has suffered. You can't deny that she sat in solitary confinement and stayed in shape by doing push-ups on the concrete floor. You can't deny how far she was willing to go and how much she was willing to sacrifice. Angela Davis, to me, is a beautiful person and a caring soul. She also does Pilates, and those are no joke. I have to get back to that myself. There are a lot of people who have money. There are a lot of people who have fame. But there are very precious few people out there dedicating their lives to making change. I look up to people like Tamika Mallory and Linda Sarsour, two of the organizers of the Women's March. I look up to Patrice Cullors and Alicia Garza, two of the women who started the Black Lives Matter movement. I look up to Malala Yousafzai, champion of girls' education, the women of the entertainment community on the front lines of the Time's Up movement, and especially the USA gymnasts who faced down their abuser in court, the trusted team doctor who had assaulted them over decades. Angela Davis's story in particular speaks to me because it's also the story of sisters, much like the sisters I'm raising. When Angela was in prison, her sister Fania Davis Jordan was the one going around the world speaking. Fania Davis Jordan built those rallies to free Angela. She was doing a lot of work, but not too many people know of Fania, because she was willing to do the thankless organizing behind the scenes to make sure that her sister was freed and their work would be seen through. Fania Davis Jordan went into the Oakland public schools where black kids were being suspended or expelled just for looking at a teacher wrong. Real school-to-prison pipeline stuff. And brought in a restorative justice approach that has almost eliminated suspensions in a bunch of schools and saved a lot of kids from juvenile prison. The number one factor in whether an adult goes to prison is not race or economics, but whether they were in prison as a juvenile, and Fania Davis Jordan has spared so many that fate. I say it, this is the power of sisters. Then I look at my daughters and say, know your role models. Be there for each other, and be there for the world. Athletes for Impact. No one changes the world who isn't obsessed. Billie Jean King. There was a famous photo from June 4, 1967, of what is called the Ali Summit. Muhammad Ali, Jim Brown, Bill Russell, Lew Alcindor, soon to be Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and several dozen other pro athletes stood together in solidarity with Ali for his resistance to the Vietnam War and refusal to submit his name for the draft. They also stated collectively that they believed that the stripping of Ali's heavyweight title, retaliation for his anti-war stance, was a grave injustice. It's a beautiful photo of an iconic moment, but it also makes me sad. I think about how important that solidarity was to Ali, for keeping him strong. And then I think about how different the world would be both on and off the field if they had been able to hold that organization of athletes from different sports together. Imagine if it had not only sustained itself, but expanded over the past 5 decades. Athletes in the last several years have done a lot of standing up and speaking out, whether in support of Black Lives Matter, Standing Rock, women's rights, or LGBTQ rights. And this is great, but we are also scattered and isolated. It's left us vulnerable and open to attack. I have been thinking a lot about the power of athletes across the sports world to join together for collective change. Kaepernick's protest and what happened to him during the 2016 season was the main inspiration for my desire to organize. Many of us around the league tried to come together to figure out how to support Colin. Different people wanted to do different things. But the message was the same. We have to act to relieve his burden. Sometimes groups of us texted each other with ideas or got together on group phone calls. but it always felt like a bunch of cooks in a kitchen who wanted to make the same dish but had different recipes. You can't organize that way. You need more than shared goals. You need shared plans and a shared organization to pound out those plans. It can't be just add water, make movement. Imagine if we'd had an organization in place by 2016. We could have lifted a lot of pressure off of Colin's shoulders, called press conferences, held our version of the Ali Summit, and done something groundbreaking. We needed to bridge the gap between his individual heroism and an organization that can make sustained change. This isn't just true of Cap. It's the lesson of the whole history of sports and politics. No one was there for Jack Johnson. No one was there for Jackie Robinson. I think about Craig Hodges and Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, two NBA players who were forced out of their league for being outspoken on injustice in the 1990s. No one in the NBA back then was willing to have their backs. If there had been an organization rooted across other sports, it could have helped Craig and Mahmoud keep their jobs and even inspired the quiet NBA players of the 1990s to step up too. We need everyone on the playing field who is conscious to come together in a single organization to support each other when we speak out. We need to have each other's backs, and we need to be willing to act together. So much value in our society is placed on the individual. The great man myth is a big part of our culture. Everyone is supposed to rise or fall on their own hard work and achievement. But social change requires solidarity, even if not especially, in the world of sports. When you look at history, any time our country has moved in the direction of fairness and justice, a lot of people acted together to make it happen. I began talking with athletes and friends more than a year ago about forming an organization. We thought we'd call it Athletes United. We allowed ourselves to imagine the size of our collective platform. We don't all have 50 million Twitter followers like LeBron, but together we could have 100 million. Shoot, if LeBron joined, we'd have 150 million. It would be kind of like having our own union across different sports, just for taking action on social issues. If there were this type of umbrella for all athletes, no matter what sport they played or league they were in, they would have a home for when shit gets hot. We talked about forming a group that included some of the greatest male and female athletes willing to confront injustice. Not to put anyone on the spot, but I got excited thinking about an organization that brought together Colin Kaepernick and Megan Rapinoe, LeBron James and Breanna Stewart, the Williams sisters and the Bennett brothers coming together to form the Super Friends of Justice, Marshawn Lynch and Maya Moore, Chris Long and Justin Britt, Mario Balotelli and David Beckham. For real, David Beckham. I think an organization like this could bring a lot of white athletes into the fold. We need more white players joining the struggle and stepping up. That's heroism to me. Chris Long's public support of the anthem actions and his donations to scholarships that promote equality are heroism. We speak about Babe Ruth or Joe DiMaggio as being legends, and on the field, they were heroes. But there's nothing heroic about silence when human rights are being violated. White athletes are going to need some cover and support to really be a part of this, and a united group would be able to provide that. Many players do important work with charitable foundations, providing after-school programs and sports camps for kids, helping the homeless, raising cancer awareness, and so much more. While this work is deeply needed, I have come to realize that we need to cross the bridge from philanthropy to activism. When Colin took a knee, it changed the national conversation about police violence and racism in a way that no amount of charitable giving could. Not everyone has been happy to have that conversation. Many even resented. But these protests have reached people, especially white people, in a way that rivals the most powerful street demonstrations. The protests have been debated on sports radio, reaching an audience that has the luxury of not having to fear the police. After Trump attacked us, polls showed that even more people understood that the protests were about racism and police brutality, not about the president, free speech, or the flag. Even when others tried to co-opt it, our message came through. And I think that's because we were so disciplined. An organization could get out these messages even more effectively. To outline my intentions, I drafted an opening declaration that read in part, "We, the undersigned people from the world of sports, are claiming our place at the front lines of the fight for a better world. There is too much oppression, too much pain, and too much hate throughout this country, and we can no longer afford to be silent. Athletes have a long history of being part of resistance movements, but often the athletes who speak out and take stands do so as individuals. Athletes United is an attempt to give an organizational expression to the voices for social justice in sports that have increasingly emerged over the last year. We can come together and support causes we care about, vocally, organizationally, and financially. And in our numbers, we will find an even greater strength. The need for such collective organizing is especially urgent right now. In a manner unprecedented for at least a generation, athletes from all sports and all walks of life have been speaking out. We have been speaking out against racism, sexism, and homophobia. We have been speaking out against Trump's travel ban. We have been advocating for education, youth programs, and services to support the communities we come from. We have been speaking out on local community issues in ways that never make the media. Especially now, faced with a president who is increasing the divisions in this country, we must not only speak out, but act." Little did I know that while I was making plans to launch Athletes United, an organization with a similar mission had formed. This team of organizers and athletes had seen the same potential and had already begun to lay the groundwork for collective action on a lot of important issues. They called themselves Athletes for Impact, A for I, and after speaking with them, I knew this would be my team off the field. One of the first actions A4I took after I joined was to release a statement in support of Colin Kaepernick. It read in part, "We call on all NFL owners, general managers, and coaches with a position to summon the courage to sign Colin Kaepernick and to stand with us on the right side of history. No one should be denied employment for having the courage to follow their convictions and take action for equality and social justice." Joining me in signing the letter were athletes including the All-Star Center for the Phoenix Mercury, Brittany Griner, who won the 2012 ESPY Female Athlete of the Year Award, Olympic fencing medalist Ibtihaj Muhammad, the first U.S. Olympian to compete wearing hijab, All-Star Seattle Storm forward Breanna Stewart, 2016 WNBA Rookie of the Year, who recently spoke bravely about sexual abuse she faced as a child, and legendary track and field Olympian, John Carlos. We've begun planning an in-person meeting where the athletes can come together to set the group's agenda and organizing priorities. An organization like this is critical to moving athletes from being mad about shit to actually doing shit. Right now, when I talk to my teammates, a lot of them crave the idea of doing more, but they don't know the steps. They don't have a map to get them to a place where they are doing something. That requires organization. I've described how pro athletes live in a bubble, where their employment is dependent on being focused from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day. So if they are going to do something outside that bubble, it needs to be simple, user-friendly, and all boxed up, ready to go. And that's exactly what can happen with A4I. As A4I develops, we can meet once or twice a year with a board or elected steering committee to set an agenda, and at these meetings, the membership would have a say in the group's direction, like shareholders. Over time, the board members could change so younger athletes would always be part of the leadership, because they have their fingers on the pulse of the pros, yet they are also not so far away from the realities of the NCAA and high school sports life. I also see travel as an important component, with a group setting up trips and programs in the Global South. This could open the eyes of high school athletes who have never traveled outside the country, and it would be uncomfortable for those people who think leaving the country means chilling at the beach in the Bahamas. But the problems around the world are our problems too, and I've seen with my own eyes the impact we could have with the most basic effort. One thing I feel strongly about is that this organization needs to be, pardon the expression, for athletes and by athletes. Too often, when an athlete gets an idea, everybody's well-meaning team gets in the way. Where there are managers and agents who understand our mission of social change as being more important than endorsement deals, we welcome their support. But the organization has to be for us and by us if it is going to be sustainable. Individuals burn out. Solid organizations last. And I think that somewhere along the way, as athletes, we have to be willing to ask ourselves, what are we doing with the influence we have? Who do we need to be? But beyond the pros with the names, eventually I see this as involving any active athlete across the world. It starts with the pros, with the people who have influence, visibility, and some authority to speak out. Then we could open up our membership to NCAA athletes, hamstrung by their own situation. Higher-ups might think they could punish college athletes for joining a group like this, but let the NCAA just try to tell scholarship athletes that they have no right to take part in an organization on their own time. Let's see how well that goes over. Once we had that base, we could talk seriously about reaching out to high school athletes, kids in middle school, elementary school, whatever it takes. Imagine a high school soccer player who wants to figure out how to use her position and leadership as an athlete to raise awareness in her school about violence against women. We could connect her with speakers who are pro athletes, do workshops with different teams, connect her with local or legal organizations, hold forums in her city, and supply her with all of these resources right through her phone or laptop. We could also offer travel opportunities for young athletes to broaden their horizons about the issues that move them. This network of athletes can have a deep and intense influence on youth, giving them a voice and a platform. We can teach them that the aspiration is not to wear an NFL uniform, but to change the world. Young people have tremendous passion inside them. We can cultivate their experiences to show them that they're not victims of their circumstances, but the masters of them. I have an after-school program in Houston I call Building Class. For 45 minutes, we talk to young people about how to be leaders, to build character, and show them that they are the future. Instead of saying, I'm Michael Bennett, be like me, we say, okay, let's help you find out who you are and what you are passionate about. I see a united organization of athletes being able to multiply that kind of mentoring 1,000-fold. We can even link up athletes across the globe. We have a long way to go, but I really feel that athletes are starting to wake up to the power they have, economically, culturally, and politically. When we fully realize it, what we can accomplish will be beyond everyone's wildest dreams. Imagine if all the athletes sponsored by Nike announced, we're not going to wear any more of your products unless you put dollars into our inner city schools that are dilapidated with old books and in poor condition, yet all the kids have on new kicks and are dying in fights over your products. You think they wouldn't give in to that demand? Did you see how quickly Under Armour changed its tune after Steph Curry, Misty Copeland, and The Rock, the company's most prominent endorsers, said they didn't like the CEO's statement supporting Trump? Athletes have so much untapped power, and once we realize what we can really do, the sky is the limit. To help us get there, A4I has outlined a position statement on some of the issues that matter the most to us, including police violence, the economy, gun violence, LGBTQ equal rights, education, climate change, immigration, and mass incarceration. Here is the athlete manifesto and vision statement that I helped draft. Athlete Manifesto. As an athlete and leader with the opportunity to influence my local community, I recognize my responsibility to use my voice and resources to make a difference. I understand the critical role athletes can play as catalysts for social change. I am committed to supporting initiatives that bring people together and educate in ways that can actively transform our local neighborhoods and communities. As an athlete for impact and champion for change, I agree to the following Hashtag A4I Principles. As an athlete for impact, I will advocate for progressive change in my community and country through the use of my influence and platform. Collaborate with organizations to create structural change by offering my assistance to local and national organizing efforts. Understand that the work I do doesn't stop with me and that justice issues are intersectional, and pledge to encourage my friends, family, fans, and fellow athletes to get involved in transforming America. The values. We, the undersigned people from the world of sports, are claiming our place at the front lines of the fight for a better world. There is too much oppression, too much pain, and too much hate throughout this country, and we can no longer afford to be silent. Athletes for Impact believes that athletes should be celebrated for their work as activists, and that all athletes can add value to social justice movements, no matter how many endorsements they have or how big their playing contract. Athletes for Impact believes in the right to speak in support of our core values and beliefs. Athletes are often told to be quiet and play the game, and that activism has no place on the field of play. We refuse to relinquish our right to speech just because we play sports, and will defend athletes who are being attacked because of their beliefs. In inclusiveness, equity, and the inherent dignity of every single person, regardless of race, gender identity, class, abilities, sexual orientation, religion, or immigration status. In the power of grassroots organizing as a way to empower local residents to come together, find solutions, and advance a more equitable future for all communities. In voting and civic activism, as a concrete way to address systemic and structural barriers to the overall health and well-being of our communities. In economic justice and investment in young people and their families to enable them to be engines of social change and transformation. In collaboration between athletes, grassroots organizers, advocacy organizations, governing bodies, and entities working on social and economic justice. In internationalism. This is not only an organization for athletes in the United States, and we affirm our commitment to stand up for our fellow athletes internationally, as well as for human rights around the world. I never thought that organizing with other athletes would be so important to me. But over the last several years, I've seen that many people in sports want to be a part of this conversation, but they're scared. The fear is rooted, when all is said and done, in a fear of retaliation, lost income, isolation, and even being killed. The fact that you can be persecuted for what you say is a scary thing. As LeBron said about Trump, he made it fashionable to hate. Yes, there is a lot of hate out there, but there is such a contrast between speaking out as an individual and as a member of an organization. There is a critical connection between an organization and your ability to speak out safely. Yes, people will tell us to stick to sports, but as Martellus drew in his cartoon, no one says stick to sports when you are using your spare time to sell McDonald's, only when you try to affect change. What I'm outlining could possibly be world-changing, bringing together athletes from around the globe to build connections and movements through sports. I can already hear people saying it's impossible, but as Nelson Mandela said, everything is impossible until you try. Mandela also said, sport has the power to change the world. It has the power to inspire. It has the power to unite people in a way that little else does. It speaks to youth in a language they understand. Sport can create hope where once there was only despair. It is more powerful than government in breaking down racial barriers. A lot of people cite that quote, but very few people have tried to put it into action to test if the great man was right. We already know it doesn't pay to bet against Mandela. Now I am going to help unite athletes in this cause and prove him right once again. You have to forgive to grow. Tennis is just a game. Family is forever. Serena Williams. My birth mother, Karonda Bennett, is 48 years old. She made that decision to take my two younger siblings and leave Martellus and me with my father. Karanda was a 17-year-old girl with two children, a 21-year-old with four children, and then a woman with five kids and a failing marriage. She chose not to raise Martellus and me. And here she is at my home, sitting around our dinner table with Pele and my three daughters. It's evening on Mother's Day 2017, one of those warm nights in Hawaii. The kind of evening where the breeze makes you feel open to the world. I start dinner by saying grace, and then I begin to cry. 6'4", 275 pounds, and I am crying. I'm crying because I'm thinking about every moment growing up as a child. Every moment we missed together, every moment I wanted to have, this moment. My tears start falling, and you could hear a pin drop in that kitchen. I explain to everyone, and it takes a moment for me to put it into words, that I'm not crying because I'm sad. I'm crying because I feel free of so much pain I didn't even realize was sitting on my chest. I am attempting to bring Karanda back into our lives, and this dinner is a part of that. I could have said, to hell with her. She wasn't here for me. But I don't want to show my daughters that carrying pain, anger, and resentment is a way to live. How can I be the kind of father I want to be if I can't forgive? If I can't forgive my birth mother, how can I be out in the world arguing for love, justice, and community? How can I hold her hostage away from my heart for something she did when she was so young? My instincts are to stay angry, but my heart says that anger is the road to ruin. I force myself to think about the cold truth. Being a parent is challenging for me, and I'm 31 at this time, with all the resources I could ask for. She was a child, basically, just a few years older than my oldest daughter, with more children than dollars in her pocket. I can't walk in her shoes, but I can guess that it probably felt day in and day out, even worse than it sounds. So how can I not forgive her? I know this is difficult for her too. Remember, I'm 31, and she's 48. We are practically peers. After grace, I tell her I am proud to know her, and I say that I feel blessed just to be able to forgive her and build a relationship so we can finally care for each other. Then everyone starts crying. I'm glad my daughters, young as they are here to see all this. I'm glad we aren't hiding this from them. I want them to see all of this and say to them that this is what a man looks like, a real man, not a facade, not just a fearless person on the field, not just someone who speaks at a rally. I don't want them to go their whole lives and say they never saw their father cry. When my birth mom and I were trying to reconnect, I knew my dad and my mom who raised me were nervous. They were scared that I would get hurt, and I think maybe they were scared that this could end with my loving them less. I could never love them less, but I couldn't go on and not be connected to the person who birthed me simply because of the decisions she made at the most difficult time of her life. I told my parents that I was trying to reconnect with her because that is how they raised me. They raised me to be the kind of man who could forgive. It's not the 1920s or the 1950s, when you were told not to be emotional, not to kiss your wife in public, not to cry in front of your daughters, and that showing charity or forgiveness was somehow a sign of weakness. This is a time when people are growing, and there is an understanding that we are more than just this flesh right here. Spiritually, I need to forgive her to grow. I can't love my wife fully unless I love my birth mom properly. As we've gotten to know each other all these years later, I'm finding out that she is a great person. Just as much as I've been hurt, she has been hurting too. She has been in Louisiana all these years, not bonded to Martellus and me. Think about how hard that's been for her, living in that tight-knit community as Martellus and I made our way through the NFL. Every day people are asking her about us, these sons she has had no connection with. It must have been devastating for her, like having a wound poked day in, day out. Like Prometheus chained to a rock, having an eagle eat her liver every day, only for it to grow back and be eaten again. a Groundhog's Day of suffering. But now she can say to them with a smile, I'm reconnecting with my family, especially with my grandchildren. Martellus isn't quite there yet. He's trying. I'm pushing him more and more to be able to do it, and he will get there in his own time. I tell him, you have to let this go, the anger, and if you don't, you won't be able to grow. Martellus did invite her to his wedding in 2017. I think that was a big step. Before his wedding day, he hadn't seen her in 10 years. It was a special moment, and I'm proud of him. My brother looks up to me, so the fact that I've made this decision to reconnect with her means he will take it seriously. It's like when he sees me being an activist, moving forward, seeing my dedication. He has slowly transformed from being seen as a comedian into a real risk-taker, someone who will put himself out there. His way is different from my way, but at the end of the day, I see him making the change. He has always been the same Martellus, but now he is the man who, in 2017, as his Patriots team went on that Super Bowl run, was raising his fist during the anthem and doing it with Belichick standing 5 feet away. After their win, he didn't go to the White House and was loud and proud about why. But it's funny how everything comes back to the beginning. We grew together through the shared hurt of our birth mother's rejection. Then we grew even closer through college, football, and being roommates. And now, as grown men, we still depend on each other. We carry each other's burdens and shoulder each other's pain, and I wouldn't have it any other way. As long as I'm moving forward safely, he will continue to take these small steps. It's like, if Michael's not getting hurt, then there must be a place for me to do the same. For years, Karanda has wanted to have a relationship, and I cannot deny her that. I don't want my kids growing up and not knowing the full truth of who they are or who their family is. I take them to Louisiana to see Bennett Road so they can know a place where everybody on the street is your family. I tell them, this is where you started. Your ancestors, after slavery, this is where they settled. After they were freed, this is the land that they had. This is the church that everybody in your family went to, and that your grandfather built with his bare hands. All these people on this street, they are some form of cousin. I think sometimes when my kids go back, they can't believe how much family they have. I try to tell them that when I die, I want my funeral to be like Muhammad Ali's. He wasn't buried in Africa. He wasn't buried in Beverly Hills. He was buried in his hometown of Louisville. I think when you die, if you are truly at peace, you should return to the beginning. And Louisiana is the beginning for me. As much as we're removed from Bennett Road, and as much as I travel around the world, this is home. I wanted my birth mom in our lives to complete the puzzle for my children. I tell them, just as much as Miss Penny is your grandma, Karanda is your grandma. They both are your grandmas, and that's okay. If somebody don't understand your story, they don't need to understand it. You have three grandmothers, and that's okay. That's life. I just wanted them to know that there is this lady who loves them. She loves you, and you do exactly what she tells you to do simply because she's your grandma. Now she stays with us for a week or two at a time. I've also taken her places she had never been before. She had never seen Florida. She had never been to Seattle. She had never seen the ocean, so I took her to see the ocean for the first time. To be her son, and to be able to take her to different places, take her to eat food she's never experienced. It's been making up for a lot of lost time. I don't think I could have opened up to this without support from Pele. It was so important for her to see me be able to move past the resentment. A lot of people might be like, she hurt you already, just move on. Let's go to the beach. Instead it was, your birth mom should come here. I'm booking a ticket for her now. But that's how we have always rolled together. We bring the support for each other. There are times I need her to be strong, to say, no, Michael, you're wrong. That's not the truth. Or, Michael, you need to get beyond that. When Pele set me on course, I knew I needed to forgive and try to bring the family together because, out of us five brothers and sisters, I'm the big brother. As the big brother, you lead your family. I tell my dad all the time, he's the father, so the family will always look up to him for certain things. But my brothers and sisters look up to me for a lot of things they would never talk to him about. To take just one example, you are probably not going to tell your mom and dad the first time you have sex. But your little brother can come to you and say, bro, I didn't know what I was doing, but those 30 seconds felt really good. I feel like I have an even bigger responsibility with this family because of having two moms. I'm trying to keep the family together and help us grow, to push the envelope and develop together. I'm asking everyone, how far can this family go? How much can we forgive? How much can we inspire each other to love each other more? Some of them tell me they're exhausted by my efforts. They say, I'm not built to forgive this much. I just want to live. I tell them, people make mistakes, and now they want to make amends. They can change, and you have to give them the chance to do that. My birth mother has evolved. You can't torture people with distance when they are trying to do right. This country has torn apart the black family, the African family, in a thousand different ways. We cannot tear each other apart. That's a form of resistance we need to take seriously. The next step in my mind is my mom and birth mother and dad all sitting together around the table, forgiving one another in front of my daughters. I have told my dad that this is what I hope to see next, and who knows, maybe by the time you are hearing this, it has already happened. That needs to be the next step for us to grow. Once the kids and grandkids see the elders forgive, the barrier will be broken, and our family will flourish. My dad will be the one who needs to shift. That man is like granite. He's old school, from a generation that still sees emotions as something you don't share, like an old movie cowboy. I think he still carries pain about my birth mother all these years later. I think he never forgave her, and until he forgives her, the wound won't heal. That will happen. I feel it in my heart, but I don't think he's there yet. Nothing against him, but it puts pressure on me to be the bridge between people and the glue to hold us together, to keep pushing the envelope, and to try to move everyone out of their comfort zones. This book is called Things That Make White People Uncomfortable, but forgiving your family? That is one thing that truly does transcend skin color. That's on all of us to confront. If it makes us uncomfortable, that's a sign we need to try harder. As for my mom who raised me, Miss Penny, she is a little scared too. I don't think she'd ever admit it, but I think she carries some fear that our relationship could suffer. I want Miss Penny to understand that she is my mom. She raised me. Everything that I am is because of her. Her gift of teaching me how to question the world is something I'll never be able to repay. I want her to know that no matter how much my relationship with my birth mom grows, it doesn't take anything away from our bond. It makes her an even greater mother, a greater human being to have done what she did. Taking on somebody else's children and raising them as her own. Her whole life is a testament to her character. There's more than enough place for both of my moms in my heart and around my table. That's my dream. A Mother's Day celebration where all the mothers are together. We go around the table, my daughters Pele and then me, and we all say what our mother means to us. And I get to talk twice. That's my idea of peace. The pain that I felt on this journey of reconnecting with my birth mom is something I need to share. I want to share it so maybe someone who is experiencing something similar doesn't feel all alone in the world. I think when you feel isolated is when you do self-destructive things, like take your life or harm yourself or withdraw and become some kind of hermit. We share our stories so we feel less alone. I can't separate the efforts to forgive and put my family together with my efforts to try and organize to change the world. Forgiveness has always been central to our black freedom struggle. I mentioned this to my dad to try to help him along on this road. I said, think about Dr. Martin Luther King. He literally could walk into a room, and be spit on, kicked, hit with a brick, have lit cigarettes flicked at his face, and keep walking, keep a level head, and show love. He was literally walking and forgiving people as they committed these transgressions, because he knew to get to where he wanted spiritually, he had to do it. I don't know if I can ever reach that level. I still get mad when a coach yells at me, or some member of the media asks me a dumbass question. 5 minutes after losing a game. So how do you feel about that loss? How do you think I feel? Even Dr. King might smack someone for that dumb shit. But I think that has to be the goal. The ability to forgive someone on the spot. It's so easy to throw a punch. It's so easy to shoot back. But to be able to forgive... There's an organization of the families of murder victims that protests against the death penalty. That's the level we need to aspire to. It's not easy when revenge is held up in movies and music as the ultimate expression of manhood, instead of how it should be seen, as the response of the child. I would argue that to get to that level of mercy and grace starts at home. It starts with forgiving people. I told that to my dad, and he was silent. Then he said, like that old movie cowboy, "I never even thought about that." It was small, but I felt him move in my direction, toward where I hope he can go. In each case, the need to forgive is a precondition for achieving justice. I can forgive anyone for anything they have said or done, or that their ancestors said or did, as long as they are willing to work with me to make sure today's version of Jim Crow, from mass incarceration to inferior access to education and nutrition to police violence, gets beaten back. There is a need to forgive but never forget, because if we are not honest about the past, we will never change our present or future. If it makes some people uncomfortable, then that's the price of change. It's not comfortable to confront the part of our history that makes us feel shame. It's not comfortable for me to sit for the anthem while people boo. It's not comfortable to lose sponsors or give away endorsements. It's not comfortable to go to parts of the world or parts of this country where suffering is a way of life. But guess what? You have to be uncomfortable to grow. When you grow as a child, it's so intense that your body is knocking your own teeth out of your mouth so stronger, better teeth can grow in. When your bones are growing when you're 12, 13 years old, it can be so uncomfortable you can't sleep at night. If we feel uncomfortable, we are doing something right. That discomfort is just a period of transition. It's not comfortable to see people in Flint, Michigan without clean water. It's not comfortable to see Philando Castile's murder at the hands of police live-streamed on Facebook. It's not comfortable to hear gymnasts tell their stories of being sexually assaulted. It's not comfortable to talk about CTE. It's not comfortable seeing kids too tired to move. But the ultimate question is, what are you going to do? Are you going to lay it on the line? Are you going to be a change maker? Remember what John Carlos said. There is no partial commitment to justice. You are either in or you're out. Trust me, if you're willing to be uncomfortable, you will also feel blessed if you can see it through and make it to the other side. Afterward, get comfortable. I was out with the kids, and we met a dude on the beach. He was a Latino guy from Portland, and he was flying a kite. He saw me with my daughters and asked, "You guys like kites?" I asked him, "How much did that kite cost?" He said, "Oh, about $10 from Costco." I said, "I want to get a kite." He replied, "Hold on. I have two kites. Take one, but first, let me show you how to fly mine." He demonstrated how to do it. Then I let my daughters take turns, but we ended up tangling it all up. It was a mess. Most people would have said, "I let you use my kite and you tangled that shit up. What is your problem?" Instead, he just smiled and told me, "You know what? I got kids too. Kids can mess stuff up. But it's about the experience, man, and it's cool that your kids got to play with the kite. It's just part of learning, brother." I was like, man, take my number. If you're ever on the other side of town, call me. He didn't know I played in the NFL or nothing. When I asked him, he didn't know a Seahawk from a mountain lion. He was just a cool person, and that's the kind of people you meet along the way in life. There's a whole bunch of great people out there, and when you let yourself be vulnerable, not build walls between yourself and others, you can make change. You have to open yourself up and get comfortable with your discomfort. Then you don't need to build more walls. Instead, they just come tumbling down. This has been a High Bridge production, read by J.D. Jackson. Copyright 2018 by Michael Bennett and Dave Zirin. Published by arrangement with Haymarket Books, care of Rome Agency. Recording copyright 2018 by High Bridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.